Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. In 2018, President Trump said, quote, "I am a nationalist. We're not supposed to use that word, but you know what? I am. I'm a nationalist," end quote. Quite an interesting moment if you pick it apart. The president acknowledges nationalism's dark historical connotations, but then goes ahead and says he's a nationalist anyway. Well, Rich Lowry says the injection of nationalism into America's political conversation is a good thing. A surprising notion from the National Review editor and one-time prominent never-Trumper. But Lowry says he wants to reclaim the definition of nationalism, that instead of an autocratic, militaristic, and xenophobic conquering impulse, Lowry sees nationalism as the foundation of democratic self-government and international peace. This hour on Point, questioning the possibility of a, quote, healthy American nationalism. And you can join us. Do you see nationalism as fundamentally problematic, or could it be possible to redefine it as a positive, benign force? How do you think a nationalist view benefits or hurts American interests or the American people? Connect with us online on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, Rich Lowry joins us today from New York. He's been the editor at National Review since 1997, and his new book is titled The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United, and Free. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Rich Lowry, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. So I just want to start off by playing that moment that I referenced at the top of the show. Just want to play the full thing to get give people an accurate reminder of what the president said. So this was the president at a rally for Senator Ted Cruz in 2018 talking about nationalism.
A globalist is a person that wants the globe to do well, frankly, not caring about our country so much. And you know what? We can't have that. You know, they have a word. It sort of became old-fashioned. It's called a nationalist. And I say, really, we're not supposed to use that word. You know what I am? I'm a nationalist, okay? I'm a nationalist. National. Nothing. Use that word. Use that word.
So, Rich Lowry, you open your book by basically asserting that we shouldn't really cringe when the president embraced that. Why not?
Well, nationalism, properly understood, it's a very old, natural, and powerful force. And throughout human history, you've had empires or totalitarian governments that have attempted to stamp out nationalism, and they always inevitably fail because it is so deeply seated in who we are as human beings. And if you just look at the American context, nationalism is part of the mainstream of the American tradition. Wouldn't have an American Revolution without it, wouldn't have a U.S. Constitution without it, wouldn't have victory in the Civil War without it, wouldn't have continental expansion without it, wouldn't have kind of the Wilson FDR foreign policy, which became the consensus foreign policy of the 20th century, based on buttressing around the world, sovereign, self-governing, and hopefully democratic nation states. So it's a tradition that really begins with Alexander Hamilton, or he's the taproot of it in America, and runs through Lincoln and TR and FDR and even Reagan. So it's a very basic sentiment or idea. So it can be used for a variety of different programs. You know, as I say, both FDR and Reagan had nationalistic aspects, but it shouldn't be a dirty word. It shouldn't be something we recoil from and turn our backs on just because the word unjustly has negative connotations or because Donald Trump uses it.
Well, okay, so a couple of things. One is that you said that that governments have tried to stamp out nationalistic impulses, but I think the opposite is also true, that governments have employed nationalistic impulses to to justify all sorts of dark moments in history. But I do wonder what you mean by nationalism? Because one of the examples that you used is, you know, we wouldn't have had an American Revolution without nationalistic impulses, but there was no nation at that time, per se.
I disagree with you. There was a nation prior to 1776. And
indigenous nations, for sure.
Well, indigenous tribes, but there was an American nation prior to 1776. And, you know, you can define these things, and the practical application always gets a little fuzzy. But nations basically distinct people united by common history and culture. And nationalism is that such a people, a distinct people, should have a distinct territory and govern that territory. And in the American Revolution, we had the choice to stay part of the British Empire or become a self-governing nation. At its most basic, that was what the revolution was about. And the American Revolution stands for the proposition that a nation has its rights and its claims that it can assert over and above a governing authority. And that's just a very key idea. That's why in the 19th century, the modern nationalist movements tend to be liberalizing, because they're about popular sovereignty. They're about citizen autonomy and citizen equality. So the idea that nationalism is inherently illiberal or inherently hateful is wrong. It can be abused and can be used for bad ends, and authoritarians can exploit it the same way Democrats, small-d Democrats, can use it. But we shouldn't turn our back on it or pretend it isn't something natural or isn't part of this America's this nation's history.
So then, so much to dig into here, Rich, but just give us then your clear definition of what you see American nationalism as. What is it when you're talking about it?
Well, I think there have been several big nationalist projects, which is the ones I just described, running through the revolution to 20th century American foreign policy. But at its most basic, and you see, heard the president, you know, saying this kind of in his inimitable way at that rally, at the most basic, nationalism says we should value our own citizens and our own interests over and above other peoples and other interests. That should be the basic of our national policymaking. And I think that's pretty much inarguable. You know, people even say, oh, we should be really concerned about climate change. They try to make the argument we should be very concerned about because of our own interest. So it's just natural that our own people are going to we're going to feel more of a connection to them than other people around the world. We have these deep cultural connections with other Americans. When I give talks about this topic, I cite the hypothetical example: if an African American meets a white American on the steps of the Paris Opera House tonight, they'll instantly have more in common than anyone around them because they are Americans and they dress largely the same way. They have the same cuisine. They have a common stock of knowledge running through the Bible and pop culture and sports. So that's what sets a people apart. It's not just political institutions or political ideas. It's culture.
Interesting. Okay, so I think that the example that you just gave is a pretty persuasive one. But going back to your assertion that there was a nationalism of sorts at work in 1776 or prior to 1776, it was by no means anywhere near as inclusive as what you just described. It was largely circumscribed by race and by religion.
Yeah. So
you approve of that form of nationalism too, though, in America. I'm a little confused about that.
Yeah. So obviously, at the outset, we had a very blinkered view of who had standing in this country and who had rights. And African Americans were part, and this is something in the New York Times 1619 project in the history of slavery that I actually very strongly support, although I reject other parts of that project. But African Americans are part of the American cultural nation from the very beginning, hugely influential. Culture of the American South, you can't really, when you get down to it, it's very hard to disentangle what are the African influences and what are the European influences, because they're all mixed up. So African Americans are part of the cultural nation, but their rights weren't recognized or protected by government. And that was the problem. And if you, again, you look through, the first 150 years of our history, it's the nationalists who work to vindicate those rights. And they're people who advance either spurious nationalism, the Confederate nationalism, which was not a true nationalism, was based around chattel slavery, protecting chattel slavery, and an exaggerated and distorted version of states' rights in order to trample the constitutional rights of African Americans. So, again, Lincoln, he's a nationalist. There's a huge element of nationalism to Lincoln. He wants to preserve the American nation state as his foremost goal in the Civil War. And he thinks if you do that, eventually you'll eliminate slavery and you'll vindicate the rights of African Americans. But first you have to protect the American nation state. And that's just a huge threat in American nationalism throughout our history. You have to have a strong and capable national government. It doesn't necessarily be extensive or meddling, but it does have to be strong and capable.
There's the underlying presumption here. I mean, it's clear in what the president says, but is it also in what you're saying in your book that that if America does not adopt this form of nationalism as you see it, that it's not acting in its best interests as a nation? Because I'm just wondering what example you would point to in the past century where the United States hasn't acted in its own best interest already.
Well, I mean, that involves policy questions and policy disputes. My contention is that all of us should be seeking what is in the best interests of the nation. And for probably 70-80% of Americans, that's a completely uncontroversial statement. For 20% who are more have more cosmopolitan orientation, it is a controversial statement. But again, this thread, it runs through Reagan, it runs through FDR. It doesn't necessarily say you have to embrace Trump's politics or anyone else's politics.
Well, Rich Lowry is editor of National Review. He's author of a new book titled The Case for Nationalism. We've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Rich Lowry. He's editor of National Review, and he's out with a new book. It's called The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United, and Free. Join us online on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Now, Rich, I just want to dig in deeper into how you define nationalism, or how you see America ought to embrace nationalism. I mean, in your book, you talk about, for example, how John Stuart Mill and his concept of nationality. To tell us more about why you turned to Mill as one of your thinkers.
Well, he's a brilliant guy, and just states some of these basic concepts more clearly than I can. But, one of the points Mill makes is that empires never hang together because they don't have sort of the basic common feeling that you need to make a polity work, certainly make a democratic polity work. And, if we don't like nationalism in nation states, a alternative model is empires. But imperial projects have very rarely been democratic, and there is a reason that the rise of the modern nation state has coincided with the rise of modern democracy. And you know, the Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire and the Habsburg Empire were relatively long lasting. Habsburgs lasted for 600 years, right in the central of Europe, controlling a huge swath of territory. But it was known as the prison house of nations for a reason. And periodically and repeatedly, there are revolts of the constituent nations that wanting to be free and govern themselves. And that's just a very natural thing. And I think it's one of the glories of the international system that the United States helped create in the 20th century, that we now have greater respect for nation states, for borders, for the sovereignty of self-governing people. And that's one of the reasons I think we've had a relative period of incredible international peace in the last 50 years or so. And then there's another alternative to the nation state, which is smaller units. But, you know, tribes can be incredibly brutal and red in tooth and claw as well. So because human nature has fallen, any collective organization, any means of organizing ourselves is going to be flawed. I just think the nation state is the most natural and has the best track record.
The most natural. Interesting. Because, I mean, I'm looking at what you wrote about Mill's concept of nationality, and this is the quote that you put in your book, that John Stuart Mill says it's a people who are united amongst themselves by common sympathies, which do not exist between them and any others, which make them more, which make them cooperate with each other more willingly than with other people. Now, I mean, I think you could describe tribes as exactly the same here, but this whole common sympathies thing. I mean, I guess you would call it culture, right? Is that what, what you're calling culture? So, how do you define what the American common culture is?
Well, it starts with the English language, absolutely central element of national cohesion. And you see it even in really, you know, nice, pleasant places like Canada. You plop a French-speaking province in the middle of an English-speaking country and you get problems and you get the country almost falling apart. So common language is hugely important. Common history is hugely important. You know, we all honor our founders, even if some of us have critiques of them and their shortcomings. A common stock of knowledge and cultural references, rituals, whether, you know, on holidays, the 4th of July or Thanksgiving. These are all things that make up American culture and are hugely important. And American culture, you know, it's open and organic. It can change and it should change. It shouldn't stay static and the same. But there is a core of it that it's that's essential to what it is to be an American.
So this is different than how a lot of people see what sort of the defining feature of America is. I mean, the holidays, et cetera, those are all the trappings that arise from what many, many others would look as the centrality of American ideas and ideals as codified in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, these Enlightenment ideals that took shape in the United States in the 18th century, and all else sort of flows from that. That is what if you're going to call it American nationalism anything, you should call it a nationalism around that set of ideals. I see you as saying something different.
Yeah, probably different in emphasis. What I react to very strongly is the exaggeration we hear very often from people on both sides and both Republicans and Democrats that America is an idea. I think that's demonstrably false. America is a nation that has ideals, and the ideals are very important. I believe the ideals are true and have had an amazing effect, not just on this country but on world history. But it's not unusual for nations to have ideals. I mean, nationalism is often has an ideological content. It's true of England. It's true of France. It's true of India and Japan and many other countries. So it's not – having ideals does not make you an idea. And I would also argue that our ideals would have meant nothing if it weren't for the success of the American nation and nation state. And again, going back to the founding. The reason why we got the Constitution, in part, because you know, Washington and Hamilton and others were worried that if we collapsed into just a set of squabbling little statelets, we'd be picked off by the European powers who are still on our periphery, and the whole project would have failed and discredited the ideals. So the ideals and the nation exist in a symbiotic relationship.
Okay. Rich Lowry, stand by for just a moment. Let's just take a quick call here. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi. So Somerville, South Carolina. I think Trump says some wrong things sometimes, speaks off the cuff. But in general, as a nationalist, he's bragging about employment for Black and Hispanic Americans, white Americans. That's great. Overseas conflicts, trying to get out of them, that's a great thing, too. Wanting fair trade with China, instead of like a 90, they sell us 90% by 10%, 60-40 split would be acceptable to me. And I just think we need to support this president more in spite of his faults. You know, we don't need to have these Stasi-like secret hearings and this endless trying to bring something up. And I think what Trump's doing for the country can just make it better and better if we get behind him more and, you know, basically make our country better for all people, Black, white, and immigrants who want to come to this country to work. I welcome them. Let them come to work. Great.
Well,
yeah, but we don't need people to sneak across the border carrying drugs and then, you know, illegal, you know, prostitution and all that stuff that's going on. It's like,
yeah, Michael, thank you for your call. So Michael, they're supporting Donald Trump's conception of nationalism. Let's go to Nick, who's calling from Portland, Maine. Nick, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First point I want to make, or comment rather, to something that was said at the opening of the show as far as, you know, this country just being made up of just basic tribes before, you know, our ancestors showed up. Is a whitewashing of pre-Columbian and post-Columbian history of this country. My second comment is that nationalism, as much as you want to paint it as being some sort of, you know, patriotism in another color, unfortunately, it's been co-opted by white supremacists, and you know, not unlike the Nazi symbol co-opted by the Nazis, it was once a benign symbol in another culture. It's been stained, and nationalism, as much as you want to paint it in another color, it's stained by the actions of white supremacists in this country and the actions of our president. And that's pretty much all I got to say about that.
Yeah. Nick, thank you so much for your call. So, Rich Lowry, you want to respond to Nick?
Yeah. So in terms of indigenous peoples, it was just – it's a sad fact that someone, if it wasn't us, was going to end up pushing – aside these pre-modern people, and maybe it would have been, you know, the Mexicans instead. Maybe it would have been the Canadian Mounties. Maybe it would have been the French or the British if they'd maintained their strong standing in North America. But someone was going to do it, and obviously we were brutal. We were dishonest. It's a shameful part of our history. We should have honored our treaties, and Native Americans should have more territory further east. Than they did, but this was just in some form or other was going to happen, and there was a big cultural conflict, even what constituted property, you know, where the Native American tribes would consider hunting grounds property, and English Americans would say, well, you're not putting down stakes and improving your land, so it's not really your property. So there's a big cultural clash there. Just in terms of white nationalists, I don't think white nationalism is a true nationalism. I think white nationalism is a contradiction in terms. And the reason why – one of the reasons nationalism is so important is it's a loyalty that's elevated above tribe, above ethnicity, above race, above any other subnational loyalty. And even if you don't want to use the word nationalism for that concept, if you want to just call it something else, fine. But that's still a hugely important concept, and I would argue that nationalism is clearly the best word for it.
So then I'm just going to read a paragraph from your book here because I just want you to explain. You write, quote, "Our cultural nation was extremely important at the outset and remains so today. At the time of the Revolution, the colonists were 80% British and almost entirely Protestant. As John Jay wrote in The Federalist No. 2, quote, Providence has been pleased to give this one connected country to one united people, a people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same religion, attached to the same principles of government, very similar in their manners and customs," end quote. You don't say that John Jay was wrong. I mean, that to me, I look at this and I say, well, he's still defining the those who make up the American nation very narrowly. It's not elevated above ethnicity or religion or language.
Yeah, so it was extremely important that the people who settled this country were from England, and especially for certain parts of England. You know, Massachusetts Bay Colony, almost everyone there comes from an area of England known as East Anglia. This is the most Protestant, kind of the most commercial-oriented, the most literate, the most skeptical of central authority area in England. And all those people kind of bring over the same sort of cultural predilections and cultural tropes that they had in England. And if instead, you know, they'd all come from Spain or all come from Russia, the country would have been totally different from the outset. And as we were talking near the beginning, obviously this is a, you know, John Jay, this is a blinkered view of America. It's a view, you know, the country will open up and become open to everyone, you know, very slowly, too slowly, tragically slowly, shamefully slowly, obviously with African Americans. But kind of the ideas of liberty that inform the Declaration, inform the formation of the U.S. Constitution, wouldn't have been there if the country had been settled from by other people from some other place.
All right. Well, Rich Lowry, stand by for just a moment, because I want to now introduce into the conversation Leah Greenfeld. She is a professor of political science at Boston University. She's written a half dozen books at least on nationalism. Her latest is Nationalism, A Short History. Also other titles such as Nationalism, Five Roads to Modernity, The Spirit of Capitalism, Nationalism and Economic Growth, and Mind, Modernity, and Madness, The Impact of Culture on Human Experience. Professor Greenfeld, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
So is this definition that Rich Lowry offers of sort of a more benign, sort of democratic form of nationalism, is it one that you recognize?
Well, let me begin by saying that we all are nationalists. We all have national consciousness, and we cannot even think outside of it. It is so natural for us. Therefore, we consider nationalism basic and natural. It is not basic and natural. However, we do not call it nationalism. We call it democracy, because it was nationalism that brought modern democracy into being. Nationalism, the word, got a very bad name because of national socialism. And for some reason, for an historical reason, we decided to reject not the word socialism, but the word nationalism. However, when we are talking about democracy, our consciousness is national. Nationalism emerged in the 16th century. It emerged in England because of a very unique historical circumstance, as a result of which the word people, that was considered the lowest classes of society, rebel, plebs, was suddenly equated with the word nation, that at that point meant an elite, specifically the sovereign political and cultural elite. And making those two words synonyms, they, people who did that quite unconsciously, created a completely new vision of society, a society as a community, a sovereign community of fundamentally equal members, in which every member was equal to another, and they called it a nation.
Okay, so let me just ask you here. So are you saying that you agree with Rich Lowry? But because I'm a little confused here. You said nationalism isn't necessarily a natural impulse, but it's also,
yes,
but it is what gave rise to democracy. I'm confused here.
Yes, absolutely right. It is not natural. It is very recent. It emerged in the 16th century.
Okay.
But it is our modern consciousness, and it is the basis of democracy. There would be no democracy without nationalism.
So then can you just, we have about a minute to go before we have to take a quick break here. Help us understand then, I mean, you talked about national socialism. In Europe, the examples are rife of how nationalism then was used, co-opted, whatever you want to say,
yes,
and turned into almost an imperialist force.
Right. That's right. Unfortunately, history is very complicated. And modern imperialism is also a result of nationalism. Nationalism is not good or bad. It is reality that completely defines our consciousness.
Okay, so Professor Greenfeld, stand by for just a second because we do have to take a quick break. Rich Lowry, hang in there as well. We are talking about Rich Lowry's new book called The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United, and Free. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Rich Lowry. He's editor of National Review and author of the new book, The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United, and Free. Leah Greenfeld also joins us. She's a professor of political science at Boston University, has written a number of books on nationalism. I just want to play here two different presidents talking about their views of nationalism. First of all, here is President Trump speaking before the UN General Assembly in September of 2018.
We believe that when nations respect the rights of their neighbors and defend the interests of their people, they can better work together to secure the blessings of safety, prosperity, and peace. Each of us here today is the emissary of a distinct culture, a rich history, and a people bound together by ties of memory, tradition, and the values that make our homelands like nowhere else on earth.
President Trump in September of 2018 talking about the upsides of a potential view of nationalism. Well, also in 2018, in a speech honoring Nelson Mandela in Johannesburg, South Africa, President Barack Obama talked about what he calls rabid nationalism and how that can tear a nation apart.
The fact that countries which rely on rabid nationalism and xenophobia and doctrines of tribal, racial, or religious superiority as their main organizing principle, the thing that holds people together, eventually those countries find themselves consumed by civil war or external war. Check the history books.
Rich Lowry, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, well, first of all, just let me say it's such an honor and a treat to be on with Professor Greenfeld, and you asked her before the break if she agreed with me. It's more I agree with her. I read her great book, Nationalism, Five Roads to Modernity, at the outset of this project. It had huge influence on my thinking. It's one reason I put such an emphasis on the English Civil War and the Glorious Revolution and the rise of the English nation vis-a-vis the crown. So it's real, again, a real treat for me. You know, I think Donald Trump's nationalism, when expressed through the teleprompter in carefully thought out speeches, is almost unassailable. I don't see how anyone can really disagree with what he said in that clip. That clip is a version, again, of what has been the consensus of American foreign policy from the 20th century on, and it's the view that self-governing people and nation states should be honored, and their borders should be honored, and there shouldn't be wars of territorial aggrandizement. And
yeah, but that's Donald Trump
correct.
Sticking to the script.
Correct.
Off-script so president, though, when he talks about nationalism off-script?
Well, then obviously, you know, he really slights what should be the unifying potential of nationalism. And this gets to the Obama clip. I think what he's really complaining about there, and this goes to conceptual and rhetorical confusion, is, you know, tribalism or racism, which aren't the same thing as nationalism. And one reason that post-colonial states in Africa and the Middle East have had such trouble cohering, have been riven by a civil war, is because in part they have artificial borders drawn by colonial powers and have had an insufficient sense of national common feeling. So again, it's not nationalism that's inherently the bad thing. It's what Obama is getting at is something else, I believe.
Professor Greenfield, do you want to respond to that?
Well, first of all, thank you, Mr. Lowry, for your compliment to me. But yes, I would like to respond. The essence of nationalism is the equation of people with an elite, with a sovereign elite. This is the basis of our value of equality, of our value of individual freedom, of an inclusive identity, which all nations have, inclusive identity of their membership. Before the people was equated with an elite, which at that time was referred to by the word nation, there was no inclusive identity in all those different geopolitical entities. If you would say to a French nobleman that he belonged to the people, this French nobleman would challenge you to a duel because this was such a terrible offense. But now we all belong together. We have an inclusive identity. However, there are very different nationalisms. Nationalism can be a force for the good. It has been, in a very large measure, a force for the good in the modern world, and it can be a terrible force for the bad. And again, it has been, in a very large measure, in the modern history, a force for the bad.
Can I just jump in? This is exactly the point I want to explore with both of you. Because any ism is an ism, right? And we have to honestly explore the good and the bad. I mean, you did start off by talking about National Socialism. I mean, we have so many comments coming in here about this. On our Facebook page, Renato says there's no need to rescue this word. That German Nazi nationalism ruined it decades ago. And if you know, you talked about it inclusive, that nationalism can be an inclusive force, but we see these vast, devastating, genocidal examples where it was used as the exclusive force. What I want to know is, what force do you see at work in the United States today in the kind of nationalism that Donald Trump seems to be espousing?
Now, again, it's very important to understand that nationalism can be both. And what does it depend on in general? It depends on the definition of the nation, the body of the nation, whether it is defined as an association of individuals or a collective individual. When it is individualistic, it is good. When it is collectivistic, it is likely to be bad. And it depends on the definition of national membership, whether it is voluntary, equated with citizenship, mm-hmm. or whether it is defined as a matter of blood, ethnically. Now, civic nationalism, as citizenship, is good nationalism. Ethnic nationalism is likely to be murderous.
Okay, so when white supremacists are marching on a university campus in America, chanting blood and soil, and that ends up in, you know, in a riot and the death of a person, and the president of the United States gets up and says, there are good people on both sides, which version of nationalism do you see there?
Blood and soil is the motto of German nationalism, which is an ethnic nationalism. Any stress on biological constitution of ethnicity or identity is very dangerous.
Rich Lowry, I haven't forgotten about you, so same question to you.
Yeah. So, look, I mean, this is one thing, a theme that comes out in the professor's book, Five Roads to Modernity, is nationalism can be shot through with a sense of grievance and of a national insecurity that's very expresses itself in very harmful ways. And this has been the German national tradition. Serb nationalism, I would say, has always been putrid from beginning to end. But, you know, America, we're not Serbs. And our nationalism has been different than Serbian nationalism. And just on the idea that the term nationalism has to be rejected because of national socialism, I think the professor's point is a very good one. So are we also saying the same thing about socialism? Should Bernie Sanders never call himself a socialist again, even though he's obviously not a Nazi and has nothing to do with Nazism? No, that should be a fine term, and it's the accurate term. And then just finally, just in considering this very bloody 20th century, the greatest killer in the 20th century was transnational ideology, especially communism, especially Chinese communism. So this is just one of the things that I consider perverse. You show up at the average faculty lounge, you know, and I'm simplifying a little bit or exaggerating, and say you're a Marxist, no one's going to bat an eyelash. You say you're a nationalist, they're going to think that's horrible, when actually it's Marxism that if you just want to do a sheer body count, killed tens of millions of people throughout the 20th century.
Well, let's go to Carol, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Carol, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling because I think we've set this word up, nationalism, at versus globalism. And I think we need to give globalism its due and explore that, too. And we're talking about ideals of this nation. Some of that is to spread democracy, right, and shore up the people that we see being oppressed around the world. And so that's an ideal that supports globalism in a sense. But it also, we're dealing with an economic system and capitalism that requires globalism, that requires an underclass, that requires manufacturing cheap goods. And so it seems a little hypocritical that some of the people that are the most fervent nationalist in this kind of way that it's been defined recently are also the most fervent capitalists that require globalism.
Well, Carol, thank you for your call. Rich, you want to respond to her?
Yeah, those are interesting points. On the tension between capitalism and nationalism, I don't think it necessarily has to exist, but clearly this is one reason that the Republican Party had lost touch with nationalism to some extent, was under the influence of libertarianism that values markets over borders, under the influence of a business elite that's become more transnational in its orientation than just national. And one way I look at this differently is I think for a long time, elites on both parties, but certainly, you know, on the right, would just think, well, our arrangement with China, it's free trade. Free trade is good, so there's no there's therefore, no question about it, any debates open and closed just on that basis, free trade. And I think there were significant downsides. I'm not sure it's a really free trade. But I do think the key question shouldn't be, well, is it a free trade arrangement? It should be whether it's in our interests or not. And if it's not, we should change the arrangement, even if it is free trade, even if it seems as though it's pro-market.
Well, I mean, the presumption has been that free trade is in our interest because it, I mean, this is the presumption, has been the economic presumption, because it's in the interest of all the nations who participate in that trading bloc. Whether or not it's been in the interest of workers within those nations is a different question here. But Professor Greenfeld, I just wondered if you had a response to our caller as well.
Well, yes. To begin with, capitalism is a product, a creation of nationalism. Historically, this is how it is. I wish I had the time to explain how this happened, but not having the time, I will just say that globalization actually is the expression of economic nationalism of the strongest economic powers. So whenever a certain state achieves sufficient economic strength, it would defend globalization. Whenever it loses this strength, it will defend protectionist nationalism.
Mm-hmm. Rich Lowry, would you have, before President Trump was elected, would you have considered thinking through the potential positives of nationalism in America? Or is it Donald Trump that has brought you to this point?
Yeah, he really occasioned my rethinking of the concept. I hadn't thought about it more than 5 minutes. I just shared everyone's assumption that, okay, it must be bad. Not sure why, but everyone assumes it's bad. That must be true. And it was the inaugural address that really got me thinking about it. I co-wrote a piece about nationalism with a colleague, and that was kind of the seed of the book. I will say the National Review has, throughout the decades, certainly the last 20 years, has argued that without using the word necessarily, that what we called the national question should be more important than it was, that sovereignty should be important, borders should be important, levels of immigration should be important, national symbols, things that we should take seriously. So there's kind of a latent nationalism there, and I would argue that there's been a strand of nationalism throughout post-World War II conservatism. It just often hasn't been identified by name.
Because a question that sort of I kept coming back to as I read your book was, given the fact that you were so opposed to Trump's candidacy, it seems as if, are you also thinking that some fundamental tenets of Trumpism are now so deeply woven into the GOP that this is an opportunity to make nationalism as spoken by Donald Trump more palatable, because you just won't get it out of what the Republican Party has become?
Well, I took this moment, National Review took this moment to rethink some things and to test some old assumptions. That doesn't mean we've thrown everything overboard. We'd never do that. But it does, circumstances change and your thinking should change or you're kind of dead. So I've changed on trade with China. I've thought through nationalism more. Still vast things about Trump that we don't like, we don't support. On policy terms, the tariffs we think are too crude and a very bad idea. The drawdown in Syria we've opposed. The meetings with Kim Jong-un we've opposed. We've had a number of important policy differences. And then there's just the way he conducts himself and the things he says. It does that no president should. And we're never going to be on board those. We've been critical of those throughout and will continue to be so.
Well, Rich Lowry is editor of National Review. His new book is The Case for Nationalism, How It Made Us Powerful, United, and Free. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Rich Lowry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
And Leah Greenfeld, professor of political science at Boston University. She's written a number of books on nationalism, including Nationalism, A Short History, and Nationalism, Five Roads to Modernity. Professor Greenfeld, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Mm-hmm.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits, so you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.